afternoon. You're listening to Freak Radio at 101.1 FM here in Santa Cruz. We're very honored to have our guests in the studio with us today, Regina and Corina Cardenas, the older daughters of Rudy Cardenas, who was murdered in cold blood by Michael Walker, a state drug agent who acted like a war criminal who murdered Rudy in cold blood on February 17th of this year. So we would very much like for you also to get more information about the case. You can go to their website, which is www.rudycardenas.net. It's all lowercase letters and all together. There's no hyphens or spaces. And Rudy spells his name R-U-D-Y, and his last name is C-A-R-D-E-N-A-S. And you can also, if you want to get in contact with them, their email address is justiceforrudy@hotmail.com. So, Regina and Corino, would you please introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your dad?
My name is Corina Cardenas, and I'm his second oldest. I'm 20 years old from San Jose, California.
And my name is Regina Cardenas. I'm the oldest daughter, 25 years old, and we have three smaller brothers and sisters. Well, as you just heard, he was killed by a state drug agent on February 17th in a case of mistaken identity. My father was a very loving man, and he would have done anything for anyone, and he didn't deserve this. I mean, nobody deserves to die this way. We don't wish this upon any family, and we just hope, I mean, we hope people are following this and that people are aware of the problems that are out there and things that law enforcement does and things that they get away with.
I know that the family, you guys were able to get an open grand jury, which indicted Michael Walker on manslaughter. Can you tell us a little bit about that process of you guys, like, pushing to just getting this open grand jury?
Well, I think the first group to put it forward for us was MAPA. They're the ones who sort of pushed for it in the beginning, and then, like, the family and other like, people who've been helping us kept writing letters, calling the DA, calling the judge. Everyone just put a lot of pressure on them in order for that to happen. Because mm-hmm. normally they keep it closed, and the only people who are allowed inside are law enforcement, basically, mm-hmm. so they can say or do whatever they want.
And an open grand jury, that is...
Basically, all it does is it says... The jury decides whether or not there is enough evidence to convict the person on trial of...
Indict. Oh, to indict.
Sorry.
It's different.
No, it's not. Okay. They indicted him, and all that says is that there is enough evidence for him to go on trial to be convicted later.
Okay.
That's all it is.
And you guys, you and a lot of... I went to the open grand juries for a few days, but you guys were there every day, like a week-long process, watching, you know, testimony, seeing these, you know, pigs up, lying, like, you know, confessing that they broke the law and not really showing any remorse.
Please tell the listeners what you were told that... What would happen to you if you expressed any emotion whatsoever in the courtroom, hearing what happened to your father and seeing the horrible pictures they put up?
They said basically if we showed any expressions whatsoever, I mean, even if we, you know, like, grinned or anything, that they would kick us out, so we weren't allowed to do any facial expressions or say anything, and we could be criminally prosecuted.
That's so, like, inhuman, you know, just so cold that that's our justice system. I mean, what is real? I mean, those, you guys are obviously, you know, entitled to real emotions, you know, and I don't know, I just think that's really gross. Like,
yeah, you have to sit there for a week-long process watching them lie through their teeth and just sit there with no emotion at all.
Also, when they were... making all kinds of demonizing accusations against Rudy, you guys also couldn't make any kind of protest, say anything. You just had to sit there and listen to it.
Basically, and a dead person can't testify, so, and we're basically made to keep quiet from the way they make it seem. And then, I mean, they also said that they were trying to say he was dealing drugs because he had all these calls, but they never revealed any of the phone numbers. I mean, we called him on a daily basis because he hardly ever answered his phone, so he had to keep calling until you finally got him to answer. But they didn't tell us who called or anything further than that.
Could you also say, explain how they were allowed to bring in all kinds of background information on Rudy's stuff that happened like 14, 15 years ago, but it was not allowed to bring any background information on Michael Walker?
Yeah, all that's kept quiet. They don't disclose any information about officers or agents, only citizens, I guess, of the public.
So do one of you guys able to just tell the story of what happened on February 17th?
Basically, there was in the probation department, or the parole department, sorry, there was this agent by the name of
Jason Lara.
And there was a parolee who, he didn't commit any crimes. All he did was he failed to check in with his parole officer. So this guy, Jason Lara, decided to call up the BNE, the Department of Justice team, who deals with gangs and stuff, because they assume because he's been in prison that he's a validated gang member, first of all.
This was David Gonzalez.
David Gonzalez. He was the parolee that they were looking for because he forgot to check in with his agent. So they got a confidential informant called and told them where he was staying. So Jason Lara went to the house to check out if it was correct or not. Mm-hmm. And that's all he was planning on doing, is seeing if, like, hey, is this true? Does this guy live here or not? So he had the other guys meet up with him later. So he was staking out the house. The other guys came and met him one by one. He briefed each of them separately, took them in his car, briefed them on, you know, this guy's his history, saying he was armed and dangerous, which we later found out wasn't even the case. And also brought up the only thing that maybe showed him be remotely dangerous was an arrest back in, it was like 15 years old, which wasn't even, they weren't even sure what it was, actually.
Right. And it was dismissed.
The charges against him.
Yeah, it was dismissed. So, I mean, they had all wrong information. He showed them a quick picture of them, sent them back to their cars, you know, and that was basically it. So they all came one by one. So my dad happened to drive by in his van. They saw a Mexican guy, said they thought they had the suspect. My dad's about 5'4". David Gonzalez is about 6 feet tall and about 60, 70 pounds heavier. And
there's an age difference.
And there's probably like a 10 to 15 year age difference. I don't remember exactly what it was. And so Agent Walker said that he thought he spotted the suspect. So we started following him, or my dad drove like towards him. So he was able to see him like basically face to face, but he said he didn't see him because he was fidgeting with his radio. So he testified that he never got a clear look at him. He didn't even know if my dad had a mustache or not. And the guy in the picture the guy that they were looking for had a very, very thick mustache. My dad did have one, but he wasn't even sure if he did or not. Yeah. So then he started chasing him.
Didn't check the license plate numbers during the chase.
Well, they didn't.
He claims that he saw it, but he never called it in. He was memorizing it for later. And so
that's what he claimed.
He called the agents, told him he was, you know, chasing a van or whatever with the suspect in it. He was sure it was him. In an unmarked vehicle, he's chasing him in plain clothes. So then it turns out he chased him through downtown and then high speed chase through downtown in the middle of the day on residential streets in an unmarked car. And meanwhile, the other agents were sort of communicating through the radios, chasing after someone as well with lights and sirens on, running red lights, not knowing who they were chasing, They forgot the name of the parolee they were even after. They
forgot his name.
Yes, they couldn't even remember when they called it in.
That's so
They didn't know where Walker was, didn't know who he was chasing or what street. They weren't familiar with the streets of San Jose, but they were running red lights and stop signs trying to find them.
Because Walker was announcing the streets he was on, and they were trying to find the streets.
Yes, being unfamiliar with the streets.
Uh-huh.
So then,
we have a caller.
So then they just, the whole time Walker was chasing my father, they were trying to find them. So then my father ended up parking his car and running on foot. Walker started chasing him, still in plain clothes. And then my father ran through an alleyway. Walker ran after him. My father jumped over the fence, continued to run down the alleyway. Walker shot him through the fence. I think he shot 5 shots. One of them hit him in the back while he was running away. Witnesses testify that he had his hands up saying, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." And I mean, and Walker was saying he had something in his hands, but he said he had a gun that was pointed at him, but they never found a gun. They never found anything except a pocket knife, which very possibly could have been planted because there was no fingerprints, no nothing on it at all. And when he shot my father, San Jose PD was first on the scene, and they patted my father down twice, and they didn't find anything. Then later on, the crime scene investigator, I believe, said they found a knife in his pocket in his clothes that were torn off and thrown in a corner somewhere. This was hours later, after he was delayed medical attention, after he was taken to the hospital, everything. So, all their stories don't add up.
And tell how, please tell the people how long the ambulance was held off. That was just like 2 seconds away.
I believe, the whole process from the time they called was about 13 minutes. And they tried to blame it on the dispatcher, but San Jose PD never called after the initial call. They were more worried about getting the scene secure, getting it set up for media coverage and stuff like that. And, I mean, the result of his death was, I mean, they said he bled to death. So had he gotten the medical care to a hospital that was, like, within a mile away, he probably would have lived.
And this was at Santa Clara Valley Medical? I'm not remembering the name of the
hospital. San Jose Medical?
San Jose Medical Center, which is one of the top hospitals in the whole entire country for trauma. So they had the facilities and the staff on there to take care of Rudy and save his life.
And, God, you know, that just sounds absolutely horrible ordeal that you guys had to go through. And, I mean, just even after this happened, the way you guys found out about your father, you know, being shot and that he might be dead, like, did you guys want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Actually, it was a Tuesday, and we used to go to bingo a lot with my mother and my grandfather, and they had called us, and my mom wanted us to go to bingo. And we go to bingo, like, at 6, 6:30, and when it was about to begin, we received a call from one of our aunts that said that she had thought that our father could have been shot and could have possibly, you know, been dead, but they just heard basically word of mouth from people who called people who called people. And then my sister, she called one of our other aunts. And do you want to say what she said?
Well, I called my grandmother actually first because I didn't want to alarm her or even tell her about it because we weren't sure what happened, but I just wanted to see if she had heard anything. So when I called my grandmother, I just basically talked to her like I normally do, like, "Hi, how are you?" you know, and she just, like, broke down and was telling me that my dad had been shot and killed, and we were still trying to put the pieces together, so I asked her how she found out, and she said the Mercury News called her. The police didn't call her, the coroner didn't call her, the newspaper called her and told her that her son had been shot. I guess how they found out was they actually ran the plates of the van. So at that point, me, my sister, and my mother, we drove downtown. We went to the hospital where they said they took him to. You know, they sent us to the emergency room. So I went to one of the windows and I asked the lady, I said, you know, I heard my father was shot. Was, you know, can you tell me if that's true? And that's all I said. And she told me, nobody by the name of Cardenas was brought in today.
So it was a lie, though.
Well, she's the one who told me his name. I didn't even say the name.
Oh, my God.
I said, nobody was shot that was brought in today? And she said, no, nobody at all.
That's criminal.
So then we then left the hospital and went to where it happened on 4th and St. James, and they had it all blocked off. So I ran over there, like, through, they had it all taped off, so I ran through where it was at, and one of the officers came up to me and told me I had to leave. And I told him, no, you know, I heard my father was shot, and I need to know if it's true, because we still don't know. And he was like, well, I can't tell you anything. I don't know anything. I can't give you any information. And then I said, well, can I, you know, they said they still haven't identified the body. So I asked him, well, can I identify it? You know, where is it? And he said, no, you can't. It has to be his wife. You know, you guys can't do it. Meanwhile, my mom was still walking to where I was, and somebody walking down the street told my mom, you know, he asked who we were. She told him, and he said, Rudy's been shot. He's been shot. They killed him. He knew who my dad was. So then we went to the coroner's office and kept calling them, but they were closed. They still wouldn't give us any information. So around 10 o'clock maybe, we went to the police station, and they said, okay, you know, we'll take you downstairs and talk to you because we're interviewing other people upstairs. So, yeah, we were in the lobby for about an hour, waiting for them to see us. So they took us to the basement, and they started, they still didn't tell us anything, really. They were just like, oh, well, you know, let me take you guys to the site. So they took me in one room, my sister in the other, and just basically interrogated us for about, I was in there way longer than she was, and I was taken first. And meanwhile, they were trying to get us to, like, say things like, oh, your dad lived on such and such street, right? No. Yeah, he did. Are you sure? Yeah, he didn't live there. Well, no, are you sure? They just kept trying to, like, put things in our mouth and, like, make us say stuff.
What total pigs. God.
Yeah. So then when we were leaving, because we still didn't know anything that was going on, the only reason why they probably talked to us was to try to get information out of us. So we were getting in the elevator, getting ready to leave, and my aunt was with us, and she got a call. It was somebody watching the 11 o'clock news, and they told her that, I guess the story that was being covered was the wrong man was shot, because we still didn't know that they were after David Gonzalez to begin with. We just thought they killed my father for whatever reason. We didn't know. So then she repeated that and said, you know, the news just told us that the wrong man's been shot. They weren't even after your dad, and the cops were in the elevator with us, and they, the whole time that we were there, the only thing they kept saying was, don't believe the media, don't believe the media. They're just making stories up. They're just trying to sell papers. That's all they kept telling us.
That is so criminal.
I just wanted to let people know that I can't remember the year it happened, but I think it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, Gustavo Sotomesa was murdered in cold blood by the San Jose cops. He was shot in the back of the head, and the cop who shot him didn't go to jail even for a second. But out of that case, what came out of it, because again, the family, how they were informed about Gustavo Sotomesa, it took them hours and hours and hours for the family to be informed. And I think, again, it was, you know, the newspaper or some horrible way the family found out that their loved one had been murdered. And so out of that, it became policy that the police have to inform the family within a specific amount of time. And again, here again with the case for Rudy, the police did not follow the own guidelines that had been set up.
Well, when we were in the police station that night, they told us that he was identified as my father by his fingerprints and his ID. But when we received the coroner's report, it said that his wife identified him, which she never did. But then right when you turn to the next page on the coroner's report, it says that the family still hasn't been notified. So since the beginning of the trial, there's been, like, many inconsistencies. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to plug the number in? Yeah, if anyone, you know, has any comments, any questions, any, you know, stories about police brutality in Santa Cruz, give us a call, free radio, 427-3772, 831-427-FRSC. And again, if you want to, you know, get some information off the internet about this case, you can go to www.rudycardenas.net. That is RudyCardenas.net, or email justiceforrudy@hotmail.com. And so the police, the state, are blatant criminals here. This is a crime against, you know, this family. And right now, do you want to tell us a little bit about the protest that y'all are organizing for, to protest the Central Coast Gang Investigators Association?
Well, Mike Walker, the one who killed my father, he belongs to CCGIA. And what they are, I guess, it's this group of agents or officers who... What they're doing right now is they're going to have a training seminar to train other officers on procedures, I guess, when they didn't follow any of their own. But it's supposed to be September 7th through the 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, in San Jose at the Doubletree on 2050 Gateway Place.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're planning on doing is protesting that, because it's not right that they're going to be doing this. I mean... It's going to be any officer can go any from California, and these aren't the people that we want training them. One of the other speakers, I believe, has been involved in the Corcoran beatings, and one of the other agents was one of the ones involved in this case with my father, who was involved in the chase, and him and Walker, childhood buddies, basically.
Is that Laura?
No, that's Brian Link.
Brian Link.
Yeah.
And Mike Walker.
And... So what we're going to do is on Saturday, September 4th, we're going to protest outside the Doubletree from 2 to 4.
Mm-hmm.
And Tuesday, the 7th, which is the first day of the seminar, we're going to protest from 8 to 10 a.m. and then again from 6 to 8 p.m. And the rest of the week from September 8th through 10th, we're going to protest from 6 to 8 p.m. outside the Doubletree. And hopefully a lot of people will come out and, you know, support the family and show that they're not for this happening.
Mm-hmm. So, again, that is protesting the CCGIA conference Saturday, September 4th will be the first protest. And I believe a press conference and rally Saturday the 4th from 2 to 4 p.m. And then Tuesday through Friday, September 7th through 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. And on Tuesday the 7th from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. as well. The Doubletree Hotel is located at 2050 Gateway Plaza in San Jose.
Place.
Gateway Place. 2050 Gateway Place, Doubletree Hotel, San Jose. And I believe there's also going to be a phone jam going on the Thursday before, which is on the third. So if you guys want to call up Doubletree Hotel and just say, you know, you're a community member who's outraged that they're allowing this racist conference to take place in San Jose, call up the Doubletree from 11 to 1 and then from 5 to 7. The phone number to the Doubletree Hotel is 408-453-4000. Again, that's 408-453-4000.
We called the Doubletree and asked them, you know, if they could not hold this, but basically they said they don't care what goes on there as long as the people pay their money. They're not going to look into it or anything like that.
Just so that you know, I spoke with somebody who has experience with organizing seminars or conferences when police people, cops and sheriffs and deputies and those kinds of people participate in a conference. And what she told me is that money is set aside in every department of the cops, sheriffs, and so that the participation of these cops, sheriffs, and deputies into this conference is not a penny is coming out of their pocket. It's taxpayer money that's paying for these guys, not only for the $95 it's costing them to spend every night at the hotel, but the $250, $290 it's costing them to participate in the conference. Meaning your tax money for any Santa Cruz cop, sheriff, or deputy who's going to participate in the conference, your money, your tax money that's that you worked hard for is paying for them to participate in a conference, for them to learn how to beat up, torture, and kill anybody that they think is a gang member.
And so I think it'd be really important for if people can get out on this Saturday, September 4th, from 2 to 4 p.m., and protest this conference, because during the grand jury trial, Mike Walker and other pigs confessed like that they broke these laws, and these are, you know, they didn't follow, you know, what, you know, their own laws, and but these people are training other pigs, you know, to deal with gangs. To me, like the pigs, the police, they're the gangsters here, right?
While they were going through the chase in San Jose, there was a San Jose PD officer who saw this happening. And he didn't want to take part in it because it was an unsafe chase for many reasons. He even, you know, told the dispatcher that somebody ought to call their supervisor because they're running red lights, or blowing red lights and running stop signs. And this is in the middle of downtown during, you know, the 1 o'clock. And, I mean, everyone's out for lunch.
And the supervisor was with them in the chase, right? Because there's, like, three cars.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. And your father was shot at a retirement home.
And there was witnesses from the retirement home who saw what happened through their window. And they all said that, you know, he had his hands up saying, don't shoot. And also the direction that Walker was firing, and there was, you know, a residential house right there. There was kids that lived there.
The other thing is this that's so outrageous. I apologize for not having it with me, but on the website for the CCGIA, you just see their racism. They have a logo of the state of California, and then they have these two cartoon-like gestures on it, but with kind of like a skull and bones look to them. So it's like really incredibly evil and racist, and it's just really, really sick. If you just see that, I don't know how anybody could even think about participating in their conference. They also claim that they're experts in dealing with gangs because of the work that they've done. And if you read their mission statement and then you look and see what seminars they're offering in the conference, it just makes your blood run cold.
So, when I attended the grand jury, Mike Walker, he got up, you know, to testify. He was packing a gun, and he showed us his gun. I mean, that's, like, really disgusting. Mm-hmm. And then he was indicted on manslaughter.
Yes, right?
Voluntary manslaughter. Voluntary manslaughter? Yeah. And he was – do you want to talk a little bit about him being arraigned, but then I guess it's been
– Well, I mean, anyone who was at the open grand jury could see that he wasn't the least bit remorseful. I mean, his whole thing was more like, you know, I'm sorry I did it because now it's a waste of my time to be sitting here in court type of thing. Because I think he said, if he wouldn't have ran, then I wouldn't have shot him and I wouldn't be sitting here defending myself today. So it was more like it was out of his way for him to be there. Not that he felt bad for killing somebody. Because, I mean, he's still, during all his, like, recorded testimonies, like, prior to the grand jury, he, you know, said, I'm not sure if he had a weapon. I'm not sure. He told a supervisor, I couldn't really tell, you know, I'm not really sure. But in court, in front of the grand jury, he kept saying, when he pointed the gun at me. But everything prior to that day, he wasn't sure. So, I mean, he had to have been trained pretty well to say that.
But even so incredibly disgusting about him is that he was always calm in the courtroom whenever he was on the stand. And he never, not once, expressed any remorse he said he did shoot Rudy, and he said, but he shot the wrong man. But he never, ever expressed any remorse for shooting and killing the wrong person. He always constantly said that he had to because he felt his life was in imminent danger because he thought that there was that Rudy had a gun in his hand. But he couldn't tell you which hand the gun was being held in.
Even though he said his life was in imminent danger, there was a 10-story building that he could have easily hid behind because he was standing right next to it. If he really thought that he had a gun, and one of the other agents that was with him did say that he hid behind the wall because, you know, he thought he might have had a gun. But in the meantime, Walker was just standing right out there in the open, but he feared for his life so much that he felt he had to shoot 5 shots at an unarmed man in the back while running away.
And Rudy never turned around and faced him. He did say Michael Walker all admitted that Rudy was always running away. He kind of like turned from his hips, but Rudy never stopped and turned around and faced him. He admitted that he shot Rudy in the back.
Yeah, shoot to kill. So Mike Walker was arraigned to go to court or start the trial on September 12th?
He was supposed to start on the 20th, I believe, but I think he just fired his attorney and hired a new one, which was probably a plan on his side, because now this new lawyer obviously has to review the case, so now his trial will be postponed until possibly January or February.
Mm-hmm. But this conference, that's next weekend, right?
That's
so
correct.
So come to that protest.
Yeah, we want to try to get as many people as we can out there on September 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And if they need more information, they can check out our website once again, www.rudycardenas.net.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, call us up at Free Radio 427-FRSC.
Or they can also write if they don't have access to email. To Justice for Rudy at 4848 San Felipe Road, number 150-146, San Jose, California, 95135.
And so I believe that, you know, after Rudy was shot and murdered, there have been quite a few other deaths in San Jose, 5 other deaths since this year.
San Jose police, not the state drug agents. Since Rudy was murdered by a state drug agent in San Jose, 5 other people have been killed in the streets of San Jose by San Jose pigs. And the most recent was Johnny Nakao, who was 21 years old. But I think it was when Rudy was killed, I think the day after or a few days after he was killed, somebody else was killed by the San Jose police. So we're in a serious crisis because it doesn't just happen in San Jose. It doesn't just happen in Santa Cruz. It happens in city after city after city. And we need to put our feet down and say, this is it, no more. Not one more stolen life by these war criminals.
And so I believe we're going to have the grandmother of Johnny Nakao calling in a little later on the show, and she's going to talk about her grandson and that incident. Is there, you know, I know that you guys, we feel that this open grand jury and this indictment has been a victory because, you know, that exposes, you know, this system, and hopefully, you know, that it'll help prevent, you know, more murders by the state from happening. Is there, you know, anything else that you women
would like? It's been a small victory. I mean, we still have a long ways to go, but it just shows how unjust the system is. I mean, if one of us were to murder somebody and, you know, admit to it that they were running away from us with no real threat to our lives, I mean, we would be thrown in prison right there until our trial date, and then probably just be sent right back to prison. But because an officer or agent did it, they have a chance at a grand jury, which, you know, we basically have to fight for and pull teeth to get. And then if they get off there, then that's basically it. That's the end of it. And even if they get indicted, as Walker did, he still gets a chance to go to another trial. So, I mean, it's a pretty unfair system, but we can't really do much about that right now. And he's getting paid about $70,000 a year. He's on paid administrative leave at the moment. Jeez. With our tax money, probably.
I would appreciate that both of you would tell all the listeners how this has changed your life as far as, because before you were pretty much apolitical people. You weren't involved in politics in any way, shape, or form. You didn't speak publicly. You just went to work and did your other stuff in your life, and how this has changed you as far as your the stand that you've had to take in life, and how it's changed your even outlook.
I think before, I mean, I was always aware there was a problem with police officers, but it never really, like, hit home. So now that it did, and just meeting with the police chief, just things that they said, and, you know, you hear them lie to your face, and you're like, oh, my God, like, I wasn't aware that they could lie like that. And it's hard because it's like our father was lost, and you have these people trying to say, like, oh, well, you know, who cares? Basically, that's what the officers are saying, and you're like, how can people even be like that? I mean, so I think it's just changed my whole outlook on, you know, just, I mean, how they are as people. They're just horrible.
Basically, we went from going to work, you know, coaching T-ball or going home or, you know, just enjoying life to basically having to go to a meeting every day to meet with people, talk to people about what's going on, inform people, and just basically stay out there and, you know, just try to touch as many people as you can with your story and, like, inform them so they can be aware of what's going on, because, like my sister just said, you don't realize it until it hits close to home. And I know you hear it a lot, but you never think it's going to happen to you, and it always happens to you. I mean, sorry, you always think it's not going to happen to you, and then when it does, it's like, oh, wow, you know, now it happened to us, so now we have to try to make a difference. And it's hard. It's a very big change. I never thought I would be at a protest, or I would be trying to hand out flyers or bumper stickers or inform people about something such as this. But you're almost, like, sort of forced in a position in a way.
So would you want to encourage, with both of you, want to encourage people to get involved before it happens to them, that, you know, they just join hands with all the others who are basically victims of police brutality, to get involved before, even though they think it doesn't touch them yet?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, it does. I mean, we know that now. It's in your community. It's all around you. And, I mean, it's sad to say, but, you know, you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or, you know, the right place at the right time, and you just get caught up in something that you have no control over. And, I mean, you're never really aware of how many families this has happened to, but now that it's happened to us, you know, there's been families who it's happened to prior to us who basically lent us a helping hand and showed us around, you know, like, what to do or what groups to talk to or what we should be doing to protest and stuff like that. And, I mean, since my father, there's been other people that it's happened to who now we need to help them, and they come to us, and it's just like this little group that you never knew about.
Yeah, I think that hearing your story and the way, you know, your family has been able to come together and bring people together is empowering, because we know that the state has a lot of control over us. We live in a minimum security prison, in a way, and I think that you are very strong women. I'm so glad to see you guys, like, you know, stepping up, being, you know, speaking out against this one of probably the most horrible situation I could think of, you know, to happen to anyone in anyone's family. And just thank you guys so much for coming. Like, really appreciate that.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and again, check out their website, www.rudycardenas.net, R-U-D-Y-C-A-R-D-E-N-A-S.net.